Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The coronavirus pandemic is just a fire drill for what is likely to follow from the climate crisis. The protests over racial injustice around the world show the need to tie together social equality, environmental sustainability, and health. Those are the words of the UN's sustainable business chief. Within the last couple of days, this hour, we want to have a look at the climate crisis anew in the current context. To ask about the connections between the COVID-19 and climate crises and the Black Lives Matter protests around the world. My guests this hour are three Iowa scholars whose work relates to climate science. We'll find out how their different areas of research, namely public health, flooding, and architecture, are preparing us to deal with the coming climate crisis. And we'll also get their reflections on the connections between the climate crisis and the pandemic, between the climate crisis and the worldwide protests over racial injustice. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Have the crises that we're starting off with in 2020 changed your mind, altered the way you look at the climate crisis? 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. My first guest, he'll be with us for the entire hour, is Peter Thorne. He's a professor and head of the University of Iowa Department of Occupational and Environmental Health, also former chair of the EPA's Science Advisory Board. That's that agency's, the EPA's, most prominent advising body. Peter Thorne, welcome back to our program.
Well, it's great to be with you, Ben. Thank you.
Let me start off by asking you very broadly, as a public health climate scientist, how has the COVID crisis informed our understanding of the climate crisis? Are there lessons?
Oh, there are definitely lessons to be learned. I think we've seen in recent time a politicization of science that has been kind of a dangerous trend. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic has shown us that we really need to look at what scientists and the science is telling us, and that should be our guide. We know from tracking the epidemic, the use of big data, the validity of the models that are being used, that these are very valuable in planning and making early decisions that minimize or greatly reduce the harm that can be caused. So when we think about climate change, the warning signs are there. We have lots of science. We have incredible models that have been built. And with COVID-19, we've had models being built. Many people have been looking at the Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 dashboard or hearing about the University of Washington Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation Projections hybrid models. These things really help guide us in making early decisions that can save money and save lives. And I think that message is loud and clear for COVID, and we should be thinking about that in terms of climate change as well.
Comment a little bit more on the politics and science, because you're absolutely right. In the present crisis, we've often had science and scientists at odds with politicians. Witness how we've seen the scientists, Dr. Anthony Fauci, Dr. Deborah Brix. So these are prominent members of the White House coronavirus task force, had to tread very carefully with their scientific data, with their informed opinions, so as not to raise the ire of President Trump. I wonder, how do we get to a better place? And perhaps you have some thoughts on what's behind the marginalization of science. I mean, you would think in pandemics, as in climate science, that science would be our ultimate guide, and politicians would pay 100% attention to science, but that's not the case.
Well, I mean, many people have watched with great interest Dr. Fauci's statement, his behaviors and his statements under the circumstances he's operating. And he's a very adept scientist as well as communicator. And I think he's shown that the scientific and medical information can break through to the public, even in such a highly charged political atmosphere. And when you look at the public's reading and understanding of COVID-19, to a large extent, I think it's being derived from what the scientists and the medical experts are saying, perhaps much more so than what the politicians are saying. At least that's my read from where I sit. Now I have this lens of as a scientist, so maybe I'm not seeing what everyone else sees.
Well, but if you look at national polls, though, right, Peter, it looks like you're right. Dr. Anthony Fauci has much more believability. I'm not sure what the phrasing was in the poll, but people trust Dr. Anthony Fauci, Dr. Deborah Brix, as scientists to tell us what is going on actually better than our politicians, it seems. I want to ask you about some other parallels here. We have, a lot of discussion about how if we had been better prepared for the COVID crisis, we could have saved a lot of lives. Some countries were much better prepared than we were. Are there parallels there to the climate crisis, preparation and prevention as opposed to being sort of caught off guard by a crisis?
Absolutely. We know that early action saves lives and minimizes harms. We know that when we delay our action, that can be catastrophic, both in terms of loss of life or increasing the burden on the healthcare system. But in addition to that, the costs involved can be greatly reduced if you move faster. And so to that end, I mean, there's a study out of Columbia University in the last month that showed that 54,000 fewer deaths would have occurred in the U.S. if social distancing had been initiated 2 weeks sooner. So, you know, we can do those kinds of analyses and put a cost of the life is lost in terms of when we make those decisions. And there are many people in the climate arena that have been saying that, you know, we are rapidly approaching these tipping points where we get to a point where the Earth cannot recover as quickly or as well if we delay actions longer and longer. And so there are those parallels as well. The other thing is that when we spend on prevention now, that we offset higher levels of spending to address the impacts later on. That's true of COVID. That's true of the impacts of climate change on sea level rise, extreme heat events, the impact on human health and livestock. That's all effect. The other thing we see from COVID is that our public health infrastructure and our resilience was not there to deal with a threat like this. And when we strengthen the public health infrastructure to deal with, say, a COVID, at the same time, we're strengthening that infrastructure for all the other things that public health intervention has to accomplish, including responses to, say, extreme heat events in the Midwest. When we have those protections in place, we have command and control, we have places to put people in cooling centers when it's hot or in shelters to isolate people, we're prepared for these events. And so it's an investment we can make that gives dividends in many different scenarios that might occur.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, my guest at the moment, Peter Thorne, he's with us for the hour, professor and head of the University of Iowa Department of Occupational and Environmental Health, also former chair of the EPA's Science Advisory Board. And in that position, Peter, you don't get to that position without being very well connected with scientists all around the country and, in fact, all around the world. We're having this discussion on public radio, but I wonder, did this discussion happen among your colleagues? Is this COVID crisis. We want to talk also about equity with the racial protests, racial justice protests here. In the actual scientific community, has COVID sort of opened some eyes or changed some thinking, caused some conversations that would not have been had there not been a COVID crisis?
Absolutely. I mean, there is certainly an element of "we told you so." You'll always have that because people have been sounding this alarm for quite a long time in terms of preparedness for disasters, and whether they be climate disasters, infectious disease epidemics, or natural disasters. We also talk a lot about those who are most at risk or who have the most susceptibility to these events. So mm-hmm. we know that the most vulnerable among our population stand to lose the most. And so that is people who are disproportionately people of color, people who are low income, and in many cases, elderly people. If you're talking about climate disasters or if you're talking about an epidemic, those groups are at higher risk. And so in order to have social justice, environmental justice, we need to protect those folks, and many times that isn't the lens with which we advance programs and policies. We think more just at the population at large, rather than focusing on the most susceptible among our citizens.
Mm-hmm. Public health climate scientist Peter Thorne of the University of Iowa. Let's also bring into our conversation Eric Tate. Eric is Associate Professor of Geographical and Sustainability Sciences also at the University of Iowa. He's a geographer whose main area of research is flooding. Eric, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Give us, to start off with broadly, a sense of your area of study a little more, how it relates to the climate crisis. You focus specifically on geography and flood as we're expecting more extreme weather in the years to come.
Yeah, so I think the work that I do is generally in two areas. Number one, what are some of the economic impacts of severe floods to buildings and infrastructure? The main focus of my work is looking at who is impacted, so extending from the what and how much to the who and how and why. And, you know, study after study, similar to what Peter was just saying around, the most vulnerable population with flood impacts, there are populations including the poor and people who may be renting, racial and ethnic minorities, those with disabilities, etc., that tend to bear the brunt of adverse impacts.
Mm-hmm. And so in both of these crises, is it true sort of in any crisis that the inequities are really shown, that the people who are well off, better off, have the infrastructure, have the housing that can, and the health system that can better protect themselves from any kind of crisis, be it a climate crisis or a pandemic?
Yeah, I think that's right. And well off can extend beyond just with financial resources. We could be connected politically, connected socially. That can be meaningful as well. The disaster research field, we talk about disasters as being revealing events, that the vulnerabilities that we talk about, whether it's from COVID or climate change or flooding, these vulnerabilities were already there. We just didn't see them or focus on them. And then, you know, COVID comes along and we say, wow, low-wage workers and elderly, frail, especially frail elderly populations and, poor black and brown populations are exceptionally vulnerable. Well, these vulnerabilities were already there. And unfortunately, some of these same groups are going to be, that are affected by COVID, are likely to be affected by climate change and are affected disproportionately by severe floods.
Mm-hmm. As a geographer, give us a little sense, an overview, a flyover, if you will, of flooding, what we expect for flooding in the years to come in the world, but perhaps here in the Midwest, considering climate change.
Well, yeah, so essentially with a warming climate, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor. And so there's generally kind of two ways that this is likely to manifest. And it's already manifesting. People talk about climate change as if things are likely to happen in the future, but we have decades of records that are showing these changes. And the two kinds of changes that we're seeing are changes in mean flooding. So on average, over the course of a year, might have more rainfall. But also the intensity of when these storms, when they occur, this rain is coming in batches that are more intense. So in Iowa, how sort of these global trends are expected to manifest is more overall rainfall and greater intensity. So really intense floods, but also intense drought.
Mm-hmm. And of course, whenever we have any one of these intense, extreme events, especially flooding, which you deal with, and we've had it in the western part of the state, and most recently we've had it in our eastern border with the Mississippi, throughout the state, floods have caused tremendous damage, and then we have to step in with flood recovery. What can you say, Eric, about research or how you've seen how funds are allocated and spent in terms of recovering, communities recovering from floods, and how that may be equal or unequal?
I guess a couple of things on that. As with any disaster, what we tend to see is that trends that exist before in terms of who is the most vulnerable tend to either be perpetuated or amplified after the disaster. So if you were, struggling before, it's likely to be, a lot more challenging afterwards. But with respect to sort of recovery spending as well, what we're broadly seeing at the federal level, and it's trickling down to local levels as well, is thinking about recovery in a broader frame of resilience. So you think about, we want to recover from a flood. Sort of the traditional approach is, well, we need to get back to where we were before the flood. So we just need to rebuild everything and just have everything in the same way. But the flaw in that is obviously is that the flood, that extreme disaster, shown that organization is highly vulnerable. So why would you...
Eric, I think we lost you. Peter, are you still with us?
I am, and
okay.
I think I can complete his sentence. You rebuild exactly what you had? It doesn't make sense.
Okay, well, we'll get word when we have Eric back. There, his phone line cut out for some reason. So, okay, Eric, I think you're still there, right?
Yes, I am here.
Okay, so Peter completed your sentence. He was quick off the mark to do that. But so why repeat the same thing if you're going to have the same area flooded again and again? And so we get to the point of rethinking that. Isn't that what flood buyouts are? And we've had them happen in so many communities, is say, wait a minute, this is a floodplain. Let's get the residential homeowners out of this area. How do we do that, right?
Yeah, it's an idea that makes a lot of sense, especially financially. We're going to buy out severely damaged structures and put a stipulation that you can't ever rebuild there again. So when the next flood hits, there's not going to be this damage. So economically, we can save a lot. We can save the need for first responders to go in and help people in those places. But it also comes with some really radical changes to communities where, because areas are in floodplains, we're going to buy out a big swath of a neighborhood. What does that mean to the people that remain, that have sort of a sense of place and community? what does this mean in rural areas where you might, you know, wipe out a good chunk of the tax base? Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to vulnerable communities? The buyouts require a lot of community capacity in terms of applying for the grants, doing the analysis, the implementation. And some recent studies have shown that it's actually the more well-resourced communities that are better able to take advantage of buyout opportunities. So even, you know, good sounding approaches like buyouts, there are complexities and challenges, and some of them associated with equity as well.
Mm-hmm. So extend your thinking a little bit more. We're coming up on a break in a couple minutes, but, you know, why keep doing the same thing over and over with the disaster striking 1, 2, 3 times after however many years? So are you saying that when we think about climate change in the future, that will become more prevalent? It'll be clearer and clearer that we just can't do the same thing again and again?
Well, we should know that already. There's not a shortage of opportunities for us to learn that lesson. But I think we need to have not only just people thinking, but policies and funding structures that reflect the ability to plan for what we want to have and what will be have greater well-being in the future, as opposed to just reproducing what we have right now.
Mm-hmm. When you look at who is affected here, disadvantaged people, I think you mentioned Native Americans, also African Americans. So specifically Native Americans, in the minute we have before the break, what have we learned about their vulnerabilities from this COVID crisis that would also apply to the climate crisis?
Well, I think that they're largely forgotten in terms of media attention, in terms of funding, in terms of who's the priority to help, Native Americans and flooding and COVID. Certainly COVID, the most vulnerable in terms of the rates is what I understand. And yet that hasn't really been a focus. We see similar things with respect to flooding. So with, it's when people don't have voice, they can be excluded from planning processes and resources.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. Continuing our conversation with Eric Tate, a geographer. He's focuses on sustainability sciences as well at the University of Iowa. Peter Thorne is with us of the Department of Occupational and Environmental Health, coming at the climate crisis with several perspectives this hour, and relating it to the COVID crisis, also to the protests over racial injustice. When we come back, we'll add another voice to our conversation. Ulrika Passa is at the Iowa State University, and she does a lot of, she's an architect, a professor of architecture. We'll talk about how architecture changes, improves, has to improve with our climate crisis when we come back. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Back with more of River to River in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're having a new look at the climate crisis in the current context of multiple other crises, to ask about the connections between the COVID-19 and climate crises, also the Black Lives Matter protests around the world. My guests so far today. Peter Thorne is still with us, professor and head of the University of Iowa Department of Occupational and Environmental Health. Eric Tate is associate professor of Geographical and Sustainability Sciences at the University of Iowa. Also joining us now, Ulrika Passa. She is associate professor of architecture, also director at the Iowa State University Center for Building Energy Research. Ulrika Passa, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you. You've been listening into the first half hour, so I'm sure you're well aware of sort of the multiple aims of this hour of discussion. But first of all, tell us about your research in architecture and how it relates to climate crisis.
Well, everything happens in buildings, right? You know, we have people, you know, 90% of their time in buildings using probably 40% of the energy which is used all over the developed world. So buildings are the cause of a lot of the challenges we have related to the climate, but they're also one of the major solutions because you can mitigate the climate change through building energy use and through the building energy design. I've worked for many years with respect to the impact of this design of spaces and buildings in urban contexts to the way they use energy. And starting with work on natural ventilation, for example, which is a spatial property to move air without using active systems to cool and to ventilate the spaces, up to passive solar strategies. You remember we built a solar house with students in 2009 at Iowa State University, which is pretty much net zero in its energy use across the year. So that all relates to climate as an impact on buildings, but also vice versa, buildings having an impact on the climate.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about how we're doing here, America, a typical American house. And I know you're a native of Germany, and houses in Germany are built quite differently. But let's take a typical American house. You're saying with the right design, the right architecture, you don't need the mechanical systems to move around air as much or at all.
That is correct, and you know we've gone a long way in the U.S. in the last 15 years. So there's a lot of good design out there, and a lot of precedents now how to design buildings with pretty much close to zero energy consumption across the year. It doesn't mean that it's never using energy from outside the building. You know, there's a balance, of course, especially in Iowa. We have the very cold winters and pretty warm and humid summers. You've just heard the weather forecast. It's warmer than usual also already in June. So, but we have all these in-between seasons, you know, the spring and the fall, where we can balance out the energy use across the year. And by, you know, orientating the building, the size of the windows, shading from trees, and shading across the windows in general, the traditional Iowa porch is one of the major features traditionally how buildings have kept warm and, you know, warm in winter and colder in summer. So there are many strategies, design strategies, which can be utilized and which are utilized these days also in the U.S. to develop buildings which are low in their energy use. And that once you have the energy consumption of the building down by the design, you can meet that need with renewable energy sources quite easily these days. Mm-hmm.
So are you saying, Ulrika, the porch, more of a bygone era? Of course, we have plenty of houses with porches, but newer ones tend not to have porches. That was not a good idea to get rid of porches when we think about energy efficiency in housing?
From my perspective, no, that was not a good idea. because those in-between spaces can mitigate the climate between the outside and the inside. You know, they can take some of the heat in winter and, you know, distribute it into the interior where it's needed. And a ventilated porch, probably you might remember sitting on a porch swing, has that nice feeling, shaded in partially outside space even in the summer. So yes, those spaces are actually needed to keep the building at a comfortable temperature, even when it's getting hotter outside or when it's colder in the winter. So those in-between spaces, the climate, the boundary conditions, the microclimate around the building can have a huge impact on how much energy is actually then needed inside the building.
Mm-hmm. So what trends, as we look at climate change, the climate crisis, and the type of weather that we're supposed to have, what, as you, as a professor of architecture, what trends do you see being driven by the climate crisis in architecture?
Well, I think there's, I mean, what's very interesting, if you look at the organizations which are driven by the profession of architecture, or you know, guided by the profession of architecture. For example, the American Institute of Architects has just recently adopted pretty stringent measures for, originally started from the Committee on the Environment for Energy Efficiency and for Climate-Related Design as their design excellency measures. So there is a big involvement in developing buildings which are more responsive to the climate and also more local in their response to their conditions. I mean, a building in California can and should look different and be designed differently than a building in Iowa, for example.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ulrika, you were listening in on the first half hour when Peter and Eric were offering their observations and about their fields of research and how the COVID crisis has sort of affected their thinking, or they've sort of drawn parallels here. I wonder if in the area, your area of architectural research, if the crises we're having currently, aside from the climate crisis, have sparked any new observations or ideas about architecture?
Well, I can certainly second what both my previous colleagues have spoken about regarding preparedness and resilience to disasters. That certainly relates to the built environment as well. For example, you know, if you in my research and also with the work with my students, we are required to look at how the climate will be in 2040, 2070, when the buildings we are currently designing are actually still going to be around. So that means we have to be much more prepared to a warmer summer, more humid, more rain, etc. Sorry, there's something in the line, unfortunately.
Yeah,
but
yeah, there is.
But the climate of the future is where the buildings of today will be operating. So we need to always look ahead. And that's, I think, something which is important to take also towards, preparedness for pandemics. I mean, obviously nobody anticipated what happened. But it's, as Eric and Peter pointed out, the areas which are most at risk are often also those which have more low-income populations, people of color. You know, we currently, I work with a large group of researchers at Iowa State University on urban climate related to urban food, energy, and water systems. And we've studied the neighborhoods in Des Moines, for example, where those which are more vulnerable economically are also those who have the least penetration of, for example, air conditioning in their homes, which is a big challenge when the climate gets warmer, and the urban climate is already warmer than the rural climate.
Mm-hmm. Ulrika, we're going to try to fix your phone there and get back to you in just a moment, but let me go back to Peter Thorne. We haven't heard from you for a while. Peter, we've got about a 10 minutes left, and I'm sure you have some other thoughts to share this hour. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, yeah, so Ulrika was talking about energy use, and I think that's another area where we've learned something from COVID. Many places during this pandemic have had a glimpse of what the post-fossil fuel energy and transportation sectors would look like in terms of air quality, and to that we can add the housing as a consumption of energy. And so places where, you know, people have struggled to see their surroundings through the smog have now had clear air. And this has become an opportunity for scientists. We sometimes refer to this as a natural experiment. Suddenly the air quality is much, much better because you've reduced the transportation, you've reduced industry. And so there was a study done in China looking at Wuhan and 367 other cities in China, and they found much, much lower air pollution, and they were able to calculate that there were 10,164 fewer deaths per month as a result of cleaner air. So as we think about the benefits to society and health of a transition away from fossil fuel energy to renewables and to e-vehicles, we can say this is how many lives we can anticipate saving. This is the healthcare costs associated with that disease, and build that into our calculations, because oftentimes those are considered externalities. And so when you put in the cost of making these transitions, those are ignored. And now we have the data where we can start to include those. And COVID-19 has provided an opportunity to get that kind of data.
Right, right, Peter. And the thought here that I was having, and your reference is interesting, because I saw some an article from, I think it was a city in India that has a lot of smog, and only during the COVID crisis, when people stopped driving, was, I think, an inhabitant, a resident of this city, able to see the nearby mountains for the first time in his life. So is it possible, by having this unintentional experiment, that people, I would think, would say, oh, that's what it can be like. That's what clean air can be like. I've never known it my entire life. We should strive for that, right? I mean, that could have provide an impetus to really enact some important policies, couldn't it?
It's definitely a teachable moment. People see what it could look like. They can feel what it could look like to breathe clean air. By the way, India has 9 of the 10 most polluted cities in the world in terms of fine particulate matter. So it is an apt example that you provide. But there are many other places of the world that have had the same experience. And here in the U.S., we have data from L.A., Seattle, New York City, Chicago, Atlanta, looking at nitrogen dioxide pollution, and great reduction in this during the time the people were self-isolating and largely had curtailment of industry and transportation. So it is an opportunity to see how it could be, and to enact policies that can direct us towards that type of air quality in the future.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to Ulrika Passa. She's back, hopefully on a better telephone line. Hi, Ulrika, again.
Yes, I'm back. Thank you so much. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
I have no idea.
I'm glad you're back. I wanted to ask you especially about architecture, because it seems in this COVID crisis, and we hope it is as short-lived as possible, of course, but we will be living with viruses and possible pandemics in the future. And you work with airflow in architecture. You work with spaces. And as we've seen in this COVID pandemic, people have fled to the outdoors to get out of our architecture, our buildings, our residences. Do you see this having any long-term impact on how we build buildings, our design of buildings, the airflow of buildings? Or is this really just too short of an instance of a crisis to have longer-term consequences for interior design and architecture?
Oh, I doubt that this will just be a sort of short-lived experience and nobody will think about it again in the future. I think there's a lot of discussion already happening right now about the impact of these spatial distancing requirements on how we live, but also how we work indoors. And that conversation is still ongoing, obviously. It's still too short to understand, but we will have to design, especially workplaces, probably very soon in a way that we can work together, but also more apart. And there are many ideas out there how to do that. But I think you talked about air movement, which, as you know, is my passion in a way, because I think we usually exchange too few air, or too little air in spaces. And, you know, opening windows is one big requirement or recommendation of the CDC for reoccupying buildings, and often you can't even do that. So I think, you know, after Hurricane Sandy, there were new requirements in New York in hospitals to be able to open windows, because, you know, when a building has no power, you can't occupy it anymore, because, you know, you are lost on air change, right? And And high air change rate is one of the major requirements also now for diluting potential contagions in the indoor spaces. So I think that certainly is going to be an ongoing conversation within the architecture community. And I'm not at a point where there are sort of stark one direction requirements, but it would be a good discussion going forward, I think. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left of our discussion this hour. Eric Tate, we haven't heard from you for several minutes here. Were there any other ideas, aspects of this conversation that you wanted to raise as a geographer and someone who is into sustainability sciences?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as tragic as COVID has been, and you know, the revealing of our society through police brutality protests, climate change, all of these offer an opportunity for us to rebuild our society in ways that are more beneficial to everybody. So as we're thinking about redesigning living spaces, as we're thinking about ways to deal with flood and public health challenges, it offers a potential to put a spotlight not only on who is harmed, but who benefits from our investments in policies and resources, and thinking about this sort of equity paradigm in when we're making these choices, and so that we can design a new environment that's beneficial to all.
Mm-hmm. Eric, I know you're on the Climate Commission for the City of Iowa City. Is there a focus on equity there? Do you see the words matching what's happening on the ground?
Certainly, we've been involved in a lot of discussions about how to transition this ideal into, you know, day-to-day decision-making. And I think that involves not only thinking about outcomes and how they're different among the population, but also processes, who's involved in decision-making processes and who has decision-making power. And thinking about everything when we're thinking about, say, how many people have been infected by COVID, and disaggregating that a little bit. So it's not just the totals, but who is impacted and where is impacted. And, you know, having a finer grain understanding of that across the population may very well lead to some different types of remedies.
Mm-hmm. Peter Thorne, we started the program with you. Your concluding thoughts as we finish up this hour.
Well, one thing that we haven't touched on that I think has been a very interesting aspect of COVID is the disruption of the meat supply. And of course, that's important to Iowans. We heard of hogs needing to be euthanized because the slaughterhouses were closed and, you know, they don't have the flexibility to take larger animals later on. And when we think about climate change, whether it's droughts, excessive heat events, flooding, that can also affect the food supply in ways that we aren't accustomed to, and we need to be thinking about that. And in our Iowa climate statements, we're working on the 10th annual Iowa climate statement now, and it will be on the topic we're talking about today. But in the past, we have talked about the impacts of climate change on agriculture, the multiple benefits of a climate smart agricultural approach. And those are things we need to be thinking of. And I think if that wasn't getting any purchase before, now looking at the impact that COVID has had on agriculture, I think that helps us realize just how significant it can be.
Mm-hmm. We have about a little less than a minute. So that Iowa climate statement comes out in the fall, and it will be, Peter, you say, very much colored by the COVID crisis and the other crises we've been having?
Yeah, lessons learned from this pandemic that inform us about climate change. That will be the topic. It's a one-page statement, 500 words, so it'll be very succinct. And this will be come out from, usually we have about 185 climate scientists in Iowa from 37 colleges and universities that sign on to it. So that we can look forward to that in the fall.
Okay, thank you very much. Peter Thorne, professor and head of the University of Iowa Department of Occupation and Environmental Health, Eric Tate, associate professor of Geographical and Sustainability Sciences at the UI, Ulrika Passa, associate professor of architecture, also director at the ISU Center for Building Energy Research. Ulrika, Eric, and Peter, thank you very much for an informative hour. We appreciate it.
Thanks much, Ben.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the program, analysis of the Supreme Court decision holding that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 does protect gay and transgender workers from workplace discrimination, one of the many political topics we'll discuss with Sarah Mitchell and Evan Renfro. I hope you'll join us tomorrow. I'm Ben Kiefer. Until then.